You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, December 26, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's part of our Best of 2012 week. I am now recovering from the Christmas celebrations at my father-in-law's, my wife's family. I have sugar poisoning from all of the marshmallow garnished food that I ate. And I'm still probably drinking right now, just to wrap up the time that I've spent in Michigan. Yet I am sober enough to make sure that you get today's Best of 2012 offering. What do we have for you? Guy Lawson, Rolling Stone contributing writer and author of the book Octopus. This is an amazing story of a hedge fund fraudster who then gets conned himself. It's just a crazy story. You're going to love it. It is fun and also disturbing in some respects, but Guy is a great guy and a great writer. And then we're also going to include a hodgepodge of some of our best of phone calls and moments from 2012. And I think I explained this at the time, but, you know, sometimes I get these random emails from publicity people who are like, today, come on to your show. We've got a guest. And it's usually right-wingers. And on one day, I just randomly picked one out of my email box. And it was a guy named Malcolm Out Loud. I don't know if that's his God-given name. It would be odd if it was. But, and so I just wrote back, yeah, I'd like to talk to Malcolm Out Loud about the Paul Ryan budget, I guess it was. I can't remember even exactly what it was. But it was rather amusing because, you know, these guys, they usually get on to right-wing radio stations. And they're just not as rigorous, I think, as we tend to be on the left. Let me put it that way. And so it was an interesting debate, if you will, with Malcolm Out Loud. So I think you're going to enjoy that. We have also got a mixture of some other stuff on this program. So don't forget that tomorrow we've got another program with the NSA whistleblowers and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, continuing our Best of 2012. Then on the 31st, we're going to be talking to Derek Jensen, author of Endgame, I think it's fair to say a radical environmental author and advocate, and also Michael Mann from the Earth System Science Center, another environmentalist, not so radical, but pretty prominent. So I think you're going to enjoy those. And then, of course, on the 1st, we'll have Corey Robin and Richard Wolf, all part of our 2012 Best Of, We'll be back live on January 2nd. But stick around. You don't want to miss these interviews. They were great the first time. They're even better than Christmas seconds the second time, if that's a thing. Do people have leftovers from Christmas? I don't know.
There should be.
All right. Well, all right. Enjoy, folks. We are back on the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to this program a writer for Rolling Stone and author now of two books. His latest is Octopus, Sam Israel, The Secret Market, and Wall Street's Wildest Con. My friend, Guy Lawson. Hello, Guy.
Hey, Sam.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well, and I'm delighted that today is publication day of Octopus. And
that's
this
right.
This is my second interview. I did one on CBS, and I came straight from broadcast television to the telephone line of the Sam Cedar Report.
Well, it's actually the Majority Report, and I'm not offended that you went to CBS first. I understand that it is, and of course it is, we're recording this on Tuesday. The book is finally released. Now, I have to say, I had heard this story from you a while back. I mean, you've been working on this book for a couple of years now. And when I read the book, I have to say, there was a moment when I was reading this in the middle of the book that I turned. I was reading it in bed, and I turned to my wife, Nikki, and I said, I cannot believe this. And so I want to thank you, because I rarely read a nonfiction book that is so just blatantly enjoyable. But and let's talk about the really sort of the fun parts of this. And then, you know, it really ties into a lot of the themes that are going on in society. Tell us the story of Sam Israel.
Sam, you're breaking up on me. I don't know what's happening.
Oh, well, I can hear you. So
okay, sorry. I don't want to break. I'm losing you a little bit on the voice there. But let's continue, obviously.
Okay.
Do you edit our stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. So I can pick up. Do you want me to start up?
Yeah. So just tell us the story of Sam Israel.
Well, the thing, you know, Sam, you know, we see each other and we're buddies, and I was telling you the story. The thing about this story is you kind of need a book to tell it. It's not something you can't really get this story over a barbecue or, you know, in an interview. But hopefully I can give your folks a good sense of it. Sam Israel was born into one of the most successful and prominent commodity trading families in the history of the United States. The Israels and the Aarons were and are very powerful and successful traders of things like soy and cocoa, you know, all the sort of stuff of modern life, coffee. Sam's great-grandfather started out with $10,000 in 1895, and by 1910 he had $25 million, which is the equivalent of $500 million today. So Sam was born into this sort of legendary family, and in New Orleans was the family's base, and then they moved to New York, and his family, he grew up at the Century Country Club, which is the most exclusive country club in the country. His family, his father played golf with, you know, Alan Greenspan and Sandy Weill and Larry Tisch. And he chased around with their children and dated their daughters. And, you know, he was born into kind of royalty, American royalty. And so by the time he was, you know, and he knew from an early age, he had a difficult relationship with his father. And he knew that he did not want to become like the other Israels. He didn't want to become another person who moved into the family business and had all that kind of, you know, like the kind of the entitlement, inherited entitlement. He wanted to go out and make himself his own man, and that was a huge motivating factor for him, this idea that he could go out and do it on his own, that he didn't need family connections. He didn't need, you know, the job being handed to him. So when he was 18, he started out on Wall Street, and he fell in with this guy named Freddie Graber. And Freddie Graber ran something called a hedge fund. And in the early 1980s, nobody knew what a hedge fund was.
Right.
There was no hedge fund industry. This was for, you know, wealthy people. This is how wealthy people secretly invested their money. It was like a secret. And so Sam went to apprentice to this Freddie Graber guy who happened to be, you know, maybe the greatest cheater of his generation. You know, Freddie knew how to work every angle. He knew how to front run the market, which means to trade ahead of, you know, the big players like the pension funds and insurance companies. He knew how to work soft dollar scams, but most of all, what he knew is how to acquire and use inside information. So Sam, you know, if people are interested in sort of the inside reality of how trading really works and how information is really passed around, Octopus, I think, the first sort of quarter of Octopus really takes you inside that world. So Sam was apprenticed into this world. And
tell me this. What is the difference? Because Sam really trained to be a trader as opposed to, I guess, an analyst or just a broker in general.
Or an investor.
What does it mean to be a trader?
Well, this is what's really interesting. It's changed. And the reason it changed is computer technology. In the 70s, you know, a trader was somebody who would pick a stock and invest in it. Something like what George Soros does, or a guy named Leon Cooperman. What you sort of imagine in a conventional investment bank advising people to do, pick stocks. But there was this form of trading, which is high velocity, which is, you know, based on trying to take advantage of immediate movements in the market, ticks up and down, that really doesn't matter what the company you're trading is. It matters only what if it's going up or down, what's going to happen in the next minute or day or perhaps week. But the theory really was that you'd start out the day in cash, you trade all day, and then you end the day in cash. And so you never own a stock. You don't care about that stock. All you're doing is trying to play the moment. And what happened in the 80s was computers came along, and computers made this kind of trading possible on a much, much, much larger scale and much quicker. So really, in the last 20 years, the money that that Wall Street makes is still, you know, to some extent based on positions and investing in companies, and IBM's got a new computer or Apple's, you know, got the iPad. But a massive amount of what they make is just this velocity trading like a nanosecond ahead of the market. So Goldman Sachs, you know, will know that there's a big velocity of shares being traded in Procter & Gamble, and they'll go in and they'll make a tenth of a cent, but they'll do it a billion times. And so Sam wanted to be that kind of trader. That kind of trader is, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you're like the tough, hard-assed. I mean, I'm trying to think of an analogy. It's sort of like being like a, you know, like if they had a reality show, it'd be like ice truckers or whatever, you know, those shows.
Yeah.
Like the extreme version. It's like you're the toughest badass on Wall Street. If you're that kind of trader, you're the guy who'll put all his money. You say you got $1 million. He'll put $1 million for 10 minutes.
And all of the training essentially and the apprenticing that Sam Israel did sort of gave him this sense that everything that was taking place on Wall Street was a function of somebody had an angle in some way or another. I mean, it wasn't like he was...
Every dollar on Wall Street is diced down to the penny.
But I mean, it seems to me that Sam Israel came through this experience. And again, we're only talking about the first quarter of the book here, which is really sort of stunning. But he comes out of this experience, it seems to me, viewing Wall Street, not that you don't have to work hard. The guy was constantly working, it seems to me.
Yeah.
That to really make it in Wall Street, and that anybody who had made it in Wall Street in some fashion or another had figured out an angle in which they were ahead of – there were almost like two classes of people, those who knew what was going on and those who didn't.
Yeah, those who are eating caviar by the spoonful and those and everyone else is a chump. It really does. It really has a great resemblance to organized crime. You know, if you're a wise guy, you don't have to have a job. I mean, that's not to say that Sam wasn't a worker, but if you're a wise guy, you know, the Wall Street guys were smart guys. They weren't wise guys. You know, they were ahead of the rest of the world is kind of a ship of fools. You know,
and
of course they know 2 days ahead in advance what's going to happen with, you know, the Exxon takeover. You know, like Facebook, the IPO.
Right.
Are you kidding me? That is institutionalized fraud. And everyone, the only reason why people were shocked was because it was such a public company. That happens. That's what happens all day, every day on Wall Street. All day, every day.
And we're talking about this now at a time as the LIBOR scandal is just growing and growing. I mean, they're talking about this has been manipulated for years. It seems that everybody knew that this was being gamed.
Of course,
regulators and the bankers. And I think for whatever reason, it's starting to fall apart at the seams. LIBOR.
Well, you know, you remember, I started talking to Sam in the September of 2008. I sit down, you know, we'll come forward to the, you know.
September 2008 now. So this is right before everything falls apart in terms of.
I sit down with Sam and he says, Wall Street's got these so many scams, you can't believe it. And then he says, you know, the Federal Reserve is a Ponzi scheme. The whole thing is bullshit. Excuse me. You, can we do that on your show, Sam?
Yeah, we'll cut it out if we have to.
Oh, really? Okay. But he says, I sit down with him, and he says that the Federal Reserve is a Ponzi scheme. The whole of Wall Street, the whole construct is basically, you know, a fantasy. And 3 weeks later, and I'm sitting there listening to him, and I'm going, And I think that I'm working on a project about a hedge fund fraudster, and he keeps insisting on all these secrets and secret bonds and secret markets, and I'm sort of listening to him thinking, well, I don't know about this. 3 weeks later, the global financial crisis hits, and, you know, I'm watching it, and I realize that Sam actually knows some stuff that's pretty powerful and pretty important and potent, and that I better listen more carefully. And so that really was when I knew I had a book, and that's when I really turned my attention to trying to understand what exactly it was that he was saying.
Now, we should say at this point, the reason why you went to interview this guy – and so let's jump to essentially close to the end of the book, because we're not, I mean, this is the at least, you know, most of the broad strokes are known publicly.
Yeah.
How we get from essentially where we've taken Sam Israel, where he was trained on Wall Street, he saw that there was like an edge to be had, and that's the way you end up, you know, that the rest of the world is a sort of a ship of fools, and these guys are the smartest guys in the room. How he ends up to what the public is aware is really, I mean, we could touch on it, but it really is just so wonderful in so many different ways and horrible in so many different ways. But so talk about the part that many people will know about Sam Israel, about the Bayou hedge fund.
Yeah, well, the Bayou became Bayou. So Sam started his hedge fund, called it Bayou because of his Louisiana roots. And, you know, he had this idea that he was going to run this really dazzling, great, honest, no more of this Wall Street fraud hedge fund. You know, he was going to cut out all the nonsense. He was going to really, you know, he'd worked on a computer program he called Forward Propagation. He believed that he, you know, if he could just get this right, he'd be able to really, you know, slay the market. So, but the thing is, you know, he was partnered with a guy who was an egomaniac, there's really no other way to put it, and had made some terrible decisions about which companies to invest in and what industries early on. And so they fell behind. So I don't know how quickly you want me to go through it, but in essence, Sam, they fudged the numbers the first year, and they came up with an accounting trick. And if any of you listeners are investors, you know, Octopus is kind of like a reverse investor's guide. You know, all these books tell you how to invest. This book tells you how not to invest, you know, because you can see how, you know, you get to see how they manipulate the financial statements. They, you know, what to look for in fraud with your investment managers. But, you know, then they just made up an auditing firm, and then they just basically invented the returns. So within 2 years, this hedge fund was, you know, a complete fraud.
And so he's trying desperately. Now this is the sort of there's so many aspects of this that I love, because Sam Israel in himself is sort of this incredibly tragic figure who you've outlined. And I get the sense that, you know, so much of this had to do with him trying to prove himself to his family in many respects.
And he's like this likable, boyish Wall Street guy who doesn't have a mean bone in his body, who's sort of a prankster. You know, he's got this alter ego he calls Captain Proton, that when he goes on a coke bender, he puts, you know, a cape on. And he's the kind of guy who leaps out of a cab at midnight and starts directing traffic at the corner of 42nd and Broadway, you know, just for a laugh. He's this sort of, you know, cut up. But at the same time, with these hedge fund guys, the more eccentric you are, the more people believe that you're a genius. The more unusual you are, the more attractive you are. And I should add here, you know, that Sam was down the road, as the pressures grew, he was diagnosed as being bipolar. And this is not an uncommon phenomenon on Wall Street. For people that take these high-risk lifestyles, up, down, you know, euphoria and depression, this is like this is the cycle of bipolarity. But, just give me a minute, okay?
Sure.
Because I think that I have an email from Sam.
Oh, you're kidding.
And this could be a world exclusive for the Majority Report. Let's see. Indeed, I do.
Yes, read it. Read it.
All right, you recording?
Yes.
All right. Well, so I went on CBS News, Network News this morning, and as I said, this is my second interview. And your readers may not know this, but the federal prison system now has email access for prisoners. And here, world exclusive, subject matter from Sam, I read to you his email to me this morning. Gee, outrageous, dude. That was fantastic. Great segment. I hope I can do as well. You could have at least said self-defense, bro. I'm reading this with you. They can't ever let anything look good. Kick that Gail King doo-doo in the doo-doo. Oprah's best friend? Ha-ha. The guy was good, though. Seriously, that the guy is Charlie Rose. Seriously, good one. Good one, King.
Folks who are listening, we're jumping all over the place, but by the end, this will make sense.
We can start over. Two
no, days. No. We're going to keep this through. This is funny because we haven't even gotten to the completely off. So you've got this guy who is the email sort of tells, like, this guy's in prison basically for life now. Is that right?
You got 22. Well, you know, the thing that we haven't said, that what most of your listeners would remember him by, and we're like 20 minutes into this, is that Sam faked his own suicide. To fast forward, you know, when Sam's fraud collapsed and he got, you know, and the bayou imploded, Sam was given 20 years, and, you know, he considered that an outrageous sentence. And I have to say, by and large, I concur. It's just white-collar crimes were underpunished, now they're overpunished, which is a kind of society-wide bipolarity.
In this instance, this is not the same systemic fraud. I mean, individuals like Sam Israel and Bernie Madoff were sort of the chum for, I think, the public.
They're the fall guys.
Yes, and now the difference between Sam Israel and Bernie Madoff, it seems, that, and we were just about to talk about this, is that Bernie Madoff went into his endeavor as a scam. Sam Israel went into it, and then halfway through, I guess, managing this fund, realized, like, he's losing, so he starts to lie about his returns, constantly convinced that he can make up the difference if he just. This is where he turns into sort of like the gambling addict, right? Who loses and then keeps going back to the table and says, "If all I need is just one big, just let it fall on 32 black."
Yeah, it's the difference between a sociopath, which is Madoff, who, you know, his business plan was to get everybody's money, as much of it as he could, and just pray he didn't get caught, against Sam, which is a human being, a real person. And I think people will relate to his story and how his motives were shaped through time. You know, beginning as a boy wanting to please his father and outshine his ancestors, to, you know, to a grown man, still in many ways a boy, who's desperately trying to save himself and his fund and his reputation and his free, you know, maintain his freedom. The stakes keep rising and rising as the vice grip closes in on him. So yeah, he, you know, over time he becomes a guy, and this is like an existential question that I think that Sam poses, which I think is an interesting one, is he's a guy who needs to make $150 million right away, and he's got $150 million to do it with. So what does he do? You know, like you say, he puts it on red eight.
Well, he doesn't exactly put it on red eight. I mean, I think, you know, like my audience right now is just sort of thinking, like, how come I sound so sort of, I guess, enamored in it? Because the part of the story that we're leaving out, which is sort of the bulk of the book.
The whole book's about this.
Is that he gets caught up in what is the functional equivalent, and I'm very familiar with this, and I don't know if I've ever even told you the story, of what is like a Nigerian email scam. And gets caught into it in a way.
Only on the scale and the complexity of, you know, of Kafka.
I mean, beyond, look, about 10 years ago, I was going through a period in my life waiting to hear if I was going to be, you know, my sitcom was going to get picked up. And I got into it with a 401, one of these Nigerian email scams. And yeah. I have 200 pages of emails that I sent back and forth with them as different characters. I have phone calls that I got from Nigeria.
That's part of why I love you, sir.
But Sam fell into this world in such a hard and total and complete way, and came so close. Well, I mean, I don't want to give away exactly what happened, but it is stunning. And more than what is stunning of that, I mean, every single, an octopus, tell us where Octopus, the name of the book, comes from.
So Sam is, you know, living in a mansion he rents from Donald Trump for $22,000 a month. He's got a fleet of Porsches. He's, you know, divorced. He sort of looks, you know, he's Bruce Wayne, the millionaire playboy.
Except for he's got massive back problems and a monkey on his back.
Massive back problems. He's the pressure, the psychological pressure of living with so many lies, his physical manifestation of it, the spiritual, all of it is just crushing him at the same time as he's, you know, on top of the world. And so he's trying to figure out how to make this money. Like, give me something. Show me somehow to make this money out, you know, so I can change my life around. Forget about Wall Street. Forget about trading anything. And he encounters this guy. And I think this is Sam, is maybe the moment when, you know, the you set out into the sea of high improbability, you know, the sea of no way. And the ocean of this can't be true. He meets this guy who was the villain in the first Superman movie. The guy, he's a giant. Remember if you remember the guy who played Jaws in the James Bond movies, like 6'9"? He's that guy. He's not that actual guy, but he's a lookalike. He's the sort of the B-movie version of that guy. And he tells Sam that he knows a CIA guy who operates out of London with access to a secret technology, a computer program that can secretly allow Sam to view the money movement inside the Federal Reserve and inside the leading banks in the world. Sam spends a night going online researching this guy, and his name is Robert Booth Nichols. Robert Booth Nichols is a superstar of the conspiracy world. This guy dealt heroin in Lebanon to support the Falangists in the wars there in the 80s. He was inside Iran-Contra. You know, he's basically, any time the United States did something nefarious in the 1970s and 80s, Nichols was there, or at least that's what's alleged. The guy lived completely off the grid, never paid any taxes, never had any income, no Social Security. He really is this mystery man. And Sam reads this book it's an unpublished book at the time called The Last Circle, and it's the story of a journalist named Danny Casolaro, who became famous in the early 1990s because he investigated these conspiracies and was working on a book he was going to call The Octopus. And Casolaro became convinced that there's this extreme right-wing cabal inside the United States intelligence agency organizations that that effectively lives above and beyond the law. It murders, this group murders, this group steals drugs. They do anything that they want in order to sort of live out America's foreign policy insanity and essentially rule the world. The thing that happens to Casolaro is that as he closes in on this story and as he encounters Robert Booth Nichols, he gets, quote-unquote, suicided. He winds up dead in a hotel in West Virginia with his wrist slashed and a dubious kind of suicide note next to him. This was very controversial.
You know, I remember when that happened. I remember reading about that.
It was Time Magazine, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Vanity Fair, Village Voice. HBO was going to do a series on it, you know? It terrified people because it seemed like Casolaro had glimpsed some alternate reality and then been murdered for it.
And frankly, you know, even after reading your book, which doesn't directly relate to that, I'm not convinced of the veracity or the lack of veracity of that theory, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. What came? I spent basically a year of my life trying to figure that out, and then I finally twigged that it didn't matter. Like, per se, what matters is that Sam believed it. That Sam moved into this universe, and he went towards this Robert Booth Nichols guy. Anybody else reading that story about Danny Casolaro would run a million miles in the other direction. But this was Sam and his risk-taking. You know, this was Sam rolling the dice. This was Sam saying, you know, I'm going to try anything. You know, like, I have balls of steel. I've got big balls.
And he also had a tremendous amount of desperation.
Yes, and a tremendous amount of money. I mean, I would urge your listeners to write out the number 150 million and look at all those zeros. It's an epic ocean of money. And so Sam travels to London on a pretext to meet with this Nichols guy. And Nichols basically, in a scene that's just straight out of Hollywood, and as far as I'm concerned at least, you know, turns Sam away from this computer program and Danny Casolaro and says, look, Sam, there's a secret bond market. There's a Federal Reserve runs a high-yield bond market, and I can get you into it, but you need to have $150 million in cash. And the next day, Sam wires $150 million to London.
All right,
that's when he enters the octopus.
Okay, so we're barely touching on just how insane it becomes at that point. Okay. Now, so, all right, I don't want to go into that anymore because I want people have got to read this to believe it. It is so stunning. There's only one other point I want to make about the plot because I want to sort of draw back out here because there's some very relevant themes in this book that really struck me, but the one thing I have to mention, and this is what I kept emailing you about, I kept telling you about, at one point in this story...
I know where you're going.
You know where I'm going. At one point in this story, all of a sudden, you know, because, like, you're just thinking, okay, Sam is living in wherever it is in Connecticut, and Darien or wherever one of those places is, and he's got this tremendous amount of money. He's living in Trump's house, like $22,000 a month. He's running
this
scheme. He's completely, he seems to me to be completely just sort of like untethered in some respects, but functional enough so that people don't realize it. And then all of a sudden, just one of the buddies that he sort of calls on to help him is John Ellis, the John Ellis who is George Bush's cousin, who called the election for George Bush in 2000 for Fox News and could be as responsible as anybody for those 8 years of George Bush. And he's one of Sam Israel's buddies who is willing to basically actually approach the White House at different times. Based on this scam, it's so hard to grasp because this is where sort of like, this is, you know, everybody else that you could possibly be aware of sort of more publicly is part of this scheme, you know, the Danny Casolaro, whatever, all these other figures who are sort of part of this sort of dark, conspiracy world. And then all of a sudden, John Ellis
shows up. And
well, it's even more than that, because John Ellis is that journalist who called the election for George Hearst's cousin.
I'll allow you to call him a journalist.
Yeah, well, there you go, and a pundit, whatever you want to call him, and now he said at that time 2004, 2003, 2004, he'd set himself up as a venture capitalist. So he was promoting various companies and working with a fund, and so he and Sam knew each other from their sons being together at this elite private school in Westchester. And so Sam said to him, looking again to make a lot of money really quickly, if you have any companies, you come across any companies that can go from 20 to 200 million fast, bring them to me. So Ellis starts presenting companies to Sam, and he starts to make money out of Sam. So the relationship isn't just like a straight up buddy thing. Ellis is really kind of in business with Sam,
right?
And becoming more and more, I don't know how to put it, but the dependence maybe is too strong a word, but he's making money out of his interactions with Bayou.
Right.
When Sam comes to him one of the most incredible scenes, in recorded human history, not to be hyperbolic, but as he comes to him with this guy, Robert Booth Nichols, this CIA guy, and the CIA guy says to John Ellis, number one, I know where Osama bin Laden is. This is 2004. He says, he's being hidden by the Pakistani army, and I can bribe the Pakistani army to give him up, and that will enable your cousin, George Bush, to win the election, because he will have caught Osama bin Laden. Okay? Then Nichols says, I also have access to a secret cache of Federal Reserve bonds hidden in caves in the southern Philippines that the Japanese stole from the Chinese in the Second World War, and I can get my group of former CIA operatives, special forces soldiers, to stage an attack on these caves on the island of Mindanao to recover these Federal Reserve bonds. And this is an imperative for national security, because this is a Muslim-dominated area, and these bonds could get into the hands of Al-Qaeda. I mean, I don't even know where...
I think we could just literally don't even have to talk anymore about it. You got to read the book to find out more.
And then Nichols says to Ellis, and I need a special diplomatic passport. It's called a black passport that is only available to super spies, Jason Bournes, and no one can stop me at any border in the world and ask me any questions, because I'm going to be dealing in the most explosive financial instruments ever to be transacted. And I want you, John Ellis, to go to your cousin, President Bush, because only President Bush can do this, and get this diplomatic passport issued.
But the best part about this to me is that John Ellis didn't just nod his head and go, sure, sure, and then sort of like never come back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay,
yeah.
I can see John Ellis will be like, right, definitely, I'm going to do this. Bye, guys. And then you never hear from him again. But he apparently... at the very least, pursued it to some extent.
Yeah, and even better than that, he contacted a guy named Fred Fielding, who was chief counsel.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. He went to the White House about this. It's not like he just said, okay, you're crazy, and leaves the house and says, boy, wow, honey, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. No, he contacts the White House.
Yeah, and even better than that, Fred Fielding comes back and says, this is... I don't know what this is, but it's probably illegal, and it might involve the CIA, so back off.
Yes.
So even Fred Fielding doesn't say, this is insane.
Right. No, that's the thing, is that I'm not so sure that, we don't really know where this guy lands. But, all right, so people got to read the book in terms of this plot, because it's just, it really is just so just crazy. Now, let me ask you this. Now I know, and you mentioned this at different.
Are we going to talk?
You mentioned this in the book at different points, that you believe that Sam believes everything he's saying.
Here's the thing. So I sit down with Sam, and he starts telling me this story in prison, and none of this story has ever been reported. Sam's never talked to anyone before, And I'm listening to this, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I like to think I'm not a fool. And so, you know, I just think this sounds like malarkey. So Sam says, you know what? I'm going to get my lawyers to give you all of my documents. And I don't mean Sam's going to go through them and pick them out. I mean all. So I go and spend $500, $1,000 on photocopying in Midtown Manhattan, and I get like 10 boxes of every travel record he's got, every bank statement, all the wires, all the depositions. And, you know, and let me just say this here, too, that the public record of this case, as it was reported in the press, was that Sam was a Bayou, the Bayou was a fraud, Sam was a scammer, he got 20 years, end of story. There were other legal proceedings taken against Robert Booth Nichols and other people involved, including John Ellis having to testify. All of it was placed under seal. It was never supposed to be released, but, you know, I got lucky and I was industrious and someone leaked it to me. So really, the essence of this story would have just been Sam talking, you know, in prison and sounding like a crazy person. But there was so much evidence to corroborate what he said, to underscore what happened with Ellis, what happened with Nichols, what happened with Fred Fielding. You know, what happened with, a special forces soldier. And, you know, so I'll just give you an example. The secret bonds hidden in the caves of southern Philippines that were stolen from the government of Chiang Kai-shek during the Second World War by the Japanese as sort of plundering loot in the Rape of Nanking. Okay? Sounds like nonsense to me, right? I spend a bunch of time researching that. I talk to the leading historians of the Federal Reserve and the leading historians of economic diplomacy during the Roosevelt administration. And here's what they say. It's likely that the Federal Reserve did issue secret bonds. I don't even know, you know, I mean, it seems to me, you know, Tom Wolfe called it the deep weirdness of modern America. It is deeply weird. This stuff is just like, you know, what waters do these people move through, you know?
It's well, now let's talk about those waters a little bit, because as I'm in the middle of reading your book, I go and see Chris Hayes speak on his book, Twilight of the Elites,
right,
and America After Meritocracy. And he talks about the about all the ways that our elites are failing. And have failed, particularly in what he called the failed decade, the past 10 years.
Yeah.
And he talks about this sort of like cult of smartness, that smartness somehow, if you're smart, there's this sort of like you have this sort of license to be able to do anything, supposedly. And
right,
that it gives you a ticket into everything, and how our system, our meritocratic system is such that it is now sort of eating itself, and it is causing a diminishment of our elites. And your book, I mean, just everything from sort of like Sam's sense of what the elites are to John Ellis, who I think, you know, you could safely call an elite. I mean, the guy's the cousin of the sitting president. He has the ability to call the White House and get an answer.
Sam was invited to the inauguration, the second inauguration. Come to the ball. I have the Christmas card from the Bushes.
So, I mean, this all just speaks of a sort of a larger societal problem. I mean, the reason why he got sucked in, it seems to me, into this big con is because it seemed so believable to him, because everything he saw on Wall Street suggested that that's the way the world worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is when you enter into a kind of a scenario where, you know, a lot of things become kind of almost religious icons. You know, the Federal Reserve, for an example, you know, it has a lot of the qualities of a church, and you know, and a modern one, a Mormon-like one. You know, it was founded in 1919 or 1917. It's, you know, they may as well say the Second Coming's in where is it again? Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like. There are elements to the way society is constructed that are fiction-like, so that when you are Sam Israel, when you are calling into question everything, well, then everything starts to look questionable. You know, if you scratch at John Ellis, you know, you find underneath a guy who is probably desperate to keep on Sam's good side, you know, and afraid of upsetting his cousin or doing something to make himself look, you know, gullible. But at the same time, you know, John Ellis, who called the 2000 election, as you say, he disagrees with that. But he can contemplate the possibility, you know, that these things are possible, that Robert Booth Nichols really is, you know, a Jason Bourne, that the world really is a Hollywood thriller.
Yes. I mean, these people who are at the very least in the court of the elite, for them, these notions, which we would hear and say, this is ridiculous, they had a ring of truth to them. And it makes you a little bit nervous as to what's really going on up there.
That's the fall of 2008 and the global financial crisis. You know, to me, in a nutshell, it's like, you know, okay, you know, Sam was like the kid shouting out the emperor's wearing no clothes. You know, the kid happened to be naked as well, but, you know, so what happens really is that Sam steps into a universe in which he, the con man, is being conned. It becomes evident over time that Robert Booth Nichols is running a confidence game on him. And this confidence game is bewildering in its complexity and also incredibly intense in its physical and emotional, the pull of it, you know, how Nichols draws him in, controls his mind, his thoughts, his fears, and essentially turns Sam into a character in a Jason Bourne movie. And you know, I don't want to spoil the book for people, but essentially it all is driving towards what happens to the $150 million. Will Sam keep it in play, or will he take it back to New York? And there's a murder scenario in the book that you know, it's hard to find stories that do something that has never been done before. But I think, you know, this murder scene I've never seen anything like it. Not to boast on my book, I just mean the story inside it.
It really is just a stunning story, and it's so. I mean, this is the part. I mean, aside from this is the part that's sort of scary. The John Ellis part. I mean, I know, like, I'm fixated on that. You know, I'm fixated on it, and it's not just because it's just like this is where this sort of completely strange sort of what feels like insular world that's running sort of parallel to the real world intersects with the real world in such a huge way that it really starts to make you question the underpinnings of a lot of stuff that we take for granted.
It's sort of Broadway Danny Rose meets The Matrix.
It's completely off the hook. And it's just, I don't even know. It's just an amazing story, and you tell it very well. And I know the tremendous amount of work that went into it. I know how many people you spoke to, and the story is.
It's kind of like, you know, setting out to report Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that there really is a Hogsworth. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, there really is, like, this thing really did happen. I have these documents. I have the courtroom testimony. I have the wire statements. I have the travel records. I have all this stuff. Every time Sam would tell me something, I go, oh, come on, man. And I'd go and look it up, and I'd see the document. You know, Sam became something called the quote-unquote benefactor in this high-yield market. Sam was going to cure AIDS.
Oh, well, that was the other part of this whole thing, is that Sam was very proud about it because he understood this whole thing to work. Without getting into it too much, Sam understood that almost all major sort of like societal and charitable sort of foundations and organizations were actually tied into this secret market, and he was going to be a big philanthropist. I mean, let me ask you this before, because we just got a couple minutes here. Have you, like, has anybody ever come to you and say, like aside from this story, or maybe this is a question I got to ask you in 6 months, but have people approach you and say, hey, look, I know you've dug into this. Here's another big piece of maybe not Sam's story, but this other story that
I suspect that's coming.
I mean, right? You're going to be the guy, right? You're going to be sort of somehow woven into this lore.
Well, you know, there's a woman out in California named Sherry Seymour who wrote a book called The Last Circle, which was published last year, and it's sort of, you know, it was what inspired Sam to go into the octopus, so to speak. And this author tried to live through what Danny Casolaro had gone through, and you know, I'm now in her book. There's a way in which, you know, I'm sort of entering into this universe, but I have young children. I have a responsibility. I have a wife. You know, I'm just not inclined to be the guy that goes off into La La Land. But I'm sorely tempted, I have to say, to go to the Philippines and hunt for these bonds.
Well, if you actually are planning to do so, let's talk about that off air, because I may be able to take a week or two. And certainly, I think my audience would appreciate my figuring out some way of funding this program.
Well, you know, it's $1 trillion worth of bonds.
Well, look, all I need is just one box full.
Yeah.
I don't even need the full trillion.
But watch out, it's booby-trapped with chemical weapons and explosives. So if you don't open it at a 45-degree angle, it's wiped out.
I got a whole plan for that. We bring a portable tub. But let's talk more about that when we get off air.
Let me leave one last thought. I don't know if we're ending now, but this story, when Sam began to tell it to the FBI, they wound up, Sam told them that he had a box of these bonds in a vault in London. They had to shut down like 6 square blocks of central London and send in the London bomb squad to get these bonds out of this vault in London. That's how much the FBI believed it's possible that Sam really had entered into a parallel universe.
And it's still unclear as to whether or not he hadn't.
That's it. You're exactly right.
Guy Lawson, the book is Octopus. You can we'll have a link at majority.fm to pick up the book. But, of course, you can go to guylawson.com to buy it on Amazon as a Kindle, Barnes & Noble, Nook, IndieBound, iBookstore, Random House, however you want to buy it.
Please support your local bookstores.
Yes, and Guy says support your local bookstores. So it's a great book, folks. I cannot recommend it enough. I still I'm going back for a second read. It's just so
I'll
crazy.
Come on again. Well, you know, I'll come on again if your listeners ever want to have that happen. I'd be delighted to come on. I'll answer questions. I'll do whatever you like, man.
Oh, that'd be great.
You know.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Guy Lawson, folks. Congratulations on the book, Guy.
Thanks, Sam. I love it.
Hi, folks. Now, you know how particular I am when it comes to accepting ads on this show. It's probably a personality defect. But finally, I can say without hesitation, the Majority Report has a dream sponsor, Credo Mobile, the only progressive cell company in the world of cell companies. Credo not only donates 1% of their revenues to progressive nonprofits you love, that's 1% of revenues, not profits, but they also fund and organize political action dictated by their progressive values. They don't care about maintaining access, and they don't care about not stepping on big funders' toes, because their customers are their funders. So they'll fight the Republican Tea Party agenda, but also hold Democrats accountable and push them to the left and against things like chain CPI, whatever. Sound familiar? I hope so. And that's why I'm so psyched Credo is helping me keep this show alive and giving you guys a great offer on cell service. It's really easy to sign up right now. Go to credomobile.com/majority to get 40% off your monthly voice fee for 1 year, true unlimited data, and They'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers. But you got to take advantage of this by December 31st. That's just days from now. That's CredoMobile.com/majority. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Malcolm Out Loud from MalcolmOutLoud.tv and author of the Out Loud Minute, which plays on 700 stations across the country on a daily basis. Welcome to the program, Malcolm.
Good to be with you, bud.
So I'm very curious. I want to start off with this Paul Ryan pick. I want to ask you, Let's start here. Paul Ryan is very closely associated, of course, with the Ryan plan, which proposes a tremendous amount, from my perspective, of cuts, and I think by anybody's perspective, of cuts, particularly to social programs. How do you think this is going to factor into the campaign over the next couple of months?
Well, it certainly is going to play into the extreme factor of Obama's campaign of class warfare, that's for sure. Of extremes, the haves and have-nots. Listen, that budget, I mean, that's, you know, the Democrats are going to obviously want to talk about that for lots of reasons. But, you know, it's not realistic. There needs to be a middle ground, and both of these parties need to understand that. There has to be a middle ground. The Ryan plan is not the plan that, you know, was enacted. It wasn't approved. We know that. And, you know, but it's substance in that plan. There has to be this balance of, you know, cutbacks being serious in this country. That's what Americans are looking for, is the difficult decisions our politicians need to make. And until that happens, I think we're going to continue to have nothing but challenges in this country. But, you know, Ryan's got some good ideas. It's just not going to be as extreme as maybe he thought it might be back when he enacted that plan or put that plan forth, you know?
Well, now give me a sense of, like, when you say get serious, what does that mean? I mean, what ideas of Paul Ryan's are good ideas?
Well, you have to remember there's we're in this sort of extreme. When I say an extremist mode, the position we have our country in right now economically is devastating. When you look at the deficit and the position of our country long term, it's devastating. This causes, this calls for extreme measures. That, I think, is what fuels things like when you say the Ryan plan and then you see plans like this coming forth. Do I think that plan was extreme? Probably. You know, again, I'm saying there needs to be a balance. We need to have cutbacks.
Where would you cut? Where do you think we need cuts?
I think we need to go in and cut. I think across the board, everything, all entitlement programs, everything.
So you would cut Social Security, everything. Medicare,
everything. Everything needs to be looked at. Everything with a capital E. We're bankrupt. We have no money.
Well, wait a second.
Just like you would do if you're a business, have to go and look at your plan.
Wait a second. What do you mean by we're bankrupt? I mean, we have our marginal tax rates at the lowest levels they've been in 70 years. I mean, so
our debt to GDP ratio in September, for the first time since World War II, is in excess of 70%. We have a debt that is close to $17 trillion. We have, combined with Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, in excess of $200 trillion in debt. I would
wait
say that's bankrupt, my friend. The only thing we haven't done is filed the paperwork,
Malcolm,
at the courthouse.
Malcolm, $200 trillion of debt in Medicare and Social Security? I don't understand that number.
When you combine Medicare, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, the debts, when you combine all of this with our $17 trillion in debt, the numbers are in excess of $200 trillion, according to the CBO.
Well, but that doesn't include, you're not calculating the revenue that comes from those programs.
Well, I mean,
people pay into taxes. People pay into taxes into Social Security. People pay in taxes to Medicare. You're just looking at the side of the ledger that says how much we've got to pay out, but you're not looking at the side of the ledger that says how much comes in.
We're in a very, very dangerous region, I believe. And I believe this program that, we think that Democrats think we can just turn the other way and not pay attention, I think is reckless at best. I don't really understand where this mentality comes from. We've never had this attitude in this country that it doesn't really matter. We'll leave the next generation worse off than we were. We've never had that attitude in this country. We took care of the next generation.
So whose tax rates would you go back to? I mean, I presume you're talking about there would be increases in taxes, right? I mean, if we're talking about having to close this deficit and debt, which, you know, the CBO projects that if we were to just go back to the Clinton tax rates, we would close the deficit within 70 years.
Well, there are going to be some very difficult decisions for the next administration, whoever it's going to be. I assure you of that. Whether it is Obama and Biden or Romney and Ryan, they're going to have to make the very difficult decisions if this country is going to be serious in moving forward with a vitality that, you know, that we want, that we're encouraged to have, that business people want to enjoy. I think, you know, you take a look at the programs and the entitlement programs and the expansion of government over these past 4 years. And it's been extensive. Do you disagree with that?
The expansion of government, I mean, it's true that there are far more people on food stamps now. That's because we've just gone through the greatest recession we've had since the Great Depression. I mean, so we have more poor people in this country. It's not that the programs have been expanded. It's that more people have become eligible for these programs because they're hurting. So would you cut children from Medicare? Get into some of these specifics, because we have a guy who has proposed the privatization of Social Security, the destruction of Medicare. If you want to add the qualifier as we know it, that's fine, I guess. I mean, but he's talking about privatizing it, leaving elderly people a substandard voucher to go and try and buy insurance on the private markets. There's barely any insurance available for people at that age, for good reason. So I'm just curious, when we talk about these in these general terms about hard decisions and whatnot, I'm just curious as to what the specifics are.
Well, you know, the same specifics that I believe got us in this position in the first place. I think we've created this society. We've created, there are two points to this that we continue to have rhetoric. And Republicans, Democrats love to talk about, what we're entitled to and what we're not entitled to. You're going to cut the children off. You're going to cut the elderly off. This is sort of the scare tactics of how we come down the road here.
Well,
and
but
we
I mean,
build
that's what it is.
Huge empire.
I mean, when but we then, cut Medicare, that's what we're doing, right? I mean,
well, listen, we can't afford, if you can tell me how we can afford the current state, if you can tell me how we can afford the current programs, then I'd say terrific.
Go back to Clinton administration
and expand them.
Go back to Clinton administration or even Reagan administration tax rates. I would raise the capital gains tax rates as well. And I would remove the cap from Social Security. You remove the cap from Social Security, that program is completely solvent until
right.
Our grandkids' grandkids collecting insurance.
This program did not happen overnight. This program has been, and this program isn't, and let me say this to you, where we're at right now, when I say this program, where we sit right now in America, is not just a short-term problem, and it didn't happen just in the last 4 years, by the way. It's happened with both political parties, and it's happened over decades. And
right.
When you come back to you talk about the previous administrations, you're correct. Because, again, I think we've passed this thing down the road all too long. And I think our political system is in really need of a revamp. I mean, until Americans hold them accountable and really look at who we have in office and are they making the tough decisions and doing the things we want them to do. We're not seeing that right
now. What constitutes a tough decision? I mean, is the tough decision you're talking about raising taxes on the wealthy or across the board?
Here's my answer.
Or is it cutting programs that literally keep elderly people out of poverty? And
here's the tough decision. Let me give it to you now. The tough decision is to balance the budget. The tough, like every state does, like every family does,
let me ask you a question.
Like every business does.
Well, no, I understand. But, I mean, you don't think that the government functions like a family.
Well, listen. Everybody on the planet has to balance a budget except the United States federal government.
Well, actually, in fact, most federal governments don't balance their budget. I mean, there's a very good argument to be made that if you were to actually get down to zero debt, it would crash the currency. But we don't have time to get into the specifics on that. But what is the problem with the deficit right now? What is it that is... I understand that it sounds very problematic, but I'm curious from your perspective, what is the problem with it?
You know, just on the surface, if you take a look at the confidence that it erodes in the American public, and just take a look at the surface for a moment of this and the sound bites of our indebtedness. That alone is dangerous and hazardous.
No, I agree.
Country.
That's why I'm questioning what's behind the sound bites. I mean, because you're talking about. Isn't the fear that that if we have too large of a debt, and obviously the deficit growing the debt, that nobody's going to loan us money? I mean, isn't that the fear that people are not going to see the country as an investment? And if that was
Well, listen, I think, you know, in spite of these things, America is still the best investment in the world.
Right.
Right. But we can't continue to say that and take advantage of that. See, if you're coming from the class.
We should be borrowing more money now. We have interest rates that are in negative territory. We actually make money when we borrow money at this point, if you include inflation in that. We have the lowest treasury bond interest rates that we've had in I don't know how many decades. And we're in a position now to
see the insolvency of our mindset and you know, just you know, everything. I mean, take a look at the credit bureaus that you're going to see. I mean, we're being threatened now. It's not just S&P. I mean, we're being, you know, between now and the end of the year and between the general election, there's going to be some difficult decisions and some hell to pay. And I think you're going to find some of these credit bureaus are also going to begin to pull down that credit rating, which has never happened in this country before.
Well, we've had a credit. Hasn't our credit rating dropped already? I mean, and that didn't affect.
But now you're looking at all the others that are also that are monitoring. And we have a negative.
Did that credit rating? Hold on, Malcolm. Did that credit rating affect our capacity to borrow?
Well, it's going to, my friend. You can't keep taking it on and taking it on. You can get by for so long, but then, you know, you're not going to be able to pull it over at the end of the day. When you say, it's how far you move the needle on the meter. I mean, how far you, sure, the S&P negative rating, maybe that wasn't as dramatic as maybe you thought it should have been or someone else, but you know what? You start adding up the other factors that are going to play into this thing ahead, and I think you're going to find that we're going to have some serious problems if we don't make the difficult choices.
But so, are those difficult choices? I mean,
we need to look at all entitlement programs, and we need, I mean, across the board.
Okay, look at them and do what?
They need to be put in check to understand what can America afford. That's the question at the end of the day.
Right. So I mean, we can afford a lot more if we raise more revenue by taxing people.
Well,
more.
we'll have to save that for another day. I have another interview here.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it. It's MalcolmOutLoud.tv and author of the Out Loud Minute on 700 stations across the country.
It's Sam Cedar introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
The other really disturbing news coming out of Iowa is that Rick Santorum apparently is branding himself with sweater vests. And I'm just beside myself. I don't know what to do about it. I'm sitting here in my own sweater vest right now. And to think that this guy has glommed on to my success with a sweater vest. I got a message for Rick Santorum, and I certainly hope, listen, what I would like to see, this is what I would love to see. I'd love to see Mitt Romney get about 22% of the vote in Iowa. 3 or 4 percentages less than he got in 2008. I would love to see Ron Paul come in first and Rick Santorum come in second. Or vice versa. I don't care. Why do I want Ron Paul to come in first or second? Because I would love the Republicans, and frankly, the whole country, have to deal with a guy who's talking about we shouldn't invade Iran. Now, I got real problems with the way he gets to his opinions that I agree with. Because at the end of the day, that's more important, frankly, in terms of trying to figure out what his opinions are going to be on other issues. But we'll talk about that in the better half of the program. And the reason why I want Rick Santorum to come in first or second is, one, I want people to understand what I have done with sweater vests. Okay? You can go back 2 or 3 months ago, look at me on Up With Chris. I was wearing a sweater vest. I've started that trend. I'll also be on his program tonight at midnight. On MSNBC, a special tonight they're talking about. The other reason I want Santorum to win is because this guy's such a nut job. But the Republicans aren't aware of who he is. The country would reject him. The guy carries around, he still has a bottle, with his stillborn, fetus, in it that they buried in his backyard or something. And this guy is a full on nut job. And is convinced that there's a lot of sluts in Boston. I mean, it goes on and on. Here's his comment. Okay? Even when they don't mean to be, if you want to understand why Republicans dislike taxes, why Republicans have a problem with any type of social services, it is because of their perception that their tax dollars goes to black people. And here's Rick Santorum accidentally saying that out loud.
Welfare here, and she told me that the state of Iowa is going to get fined if they don't sign up more people under the Medicaid program. They're just pushing harder and harder to get more and more of you dependent upon them so they can get your vote. That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money and provide for themselves and their families. And the best way to do that...
Did you hear what he said? I don't want to give black people other people's money and make their life better. Now, aside from the fact that the majority of welfare recipients are white, but that's not the relevant. Now,
he makes it sound like there's no working black people.
Oh, yeah. Well, but... what he's getting at is exactly what is why Republicans don't like taxes. Because I don't want to give money to black people. Now, to be fair, his campaign has said he didn't say black people. He said blah people or bly people. I'm not joking. That's what they said, blah people. Play it again. Let's just give them the benefit of the doubt.
Welfare here, and she told me that the state of Iowa is going to get fined if they don't sign up more people under the Medicaid program. They're just pushing harder and harder to get more and more of you dependent upon them so they can get your vote. That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money.
No, I know what he's trying to say. No, he didn't say, I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody. He said, I don't want to give blah people. You know, blah people.
I think I heard blag people.
Blag people.
Blag people.
Right, blag people. Well, of course. No, you don't want to give blag people that because they have blagness. Rick Santorum, I want you to know I'm rooting for you tonight. I hope you do well. And then you should maybe give me a little credit for sweater vests.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
People who want health insurance should buy health insurance. Simple. Why should I pay for your health care? Get your own. I'll do the same. Well, Primer, first off, if I don't have health insurance, you pay for my health care. In fact, you already pay for other people's health care. In two different ways, you pay for other people's health care. One, with your tax dollars. Two, with either higher insurance premiums or actually higher cost for your care because you're subsidizing other people who don't pay for their health care. That's the bottom line. But I do think, Primer, that is instructive for people to understand what this is about. There was a time in this country where there was agreement about the need for universal health care. That's why Republicans in the early 90s came up with this idea that is now called the Affordable Care Act. But what we see, what Primer is showing us, is that the right wing in this country fundamentally do not believe that society exists so that we can take care of those who cannot afford to take care of themselves. Whether you get hit by a bus or you have cancer, if you don't have the money to pay for health insurance and therefore have no capacity to pay for health care, then you die. That's it. And the question is, does the American people subscribe to Primer's vision of what American society should be or Primer's vision of what American society should be? There is no free lunch, he says, as he IMs me on the internet that was, in fact, developed by the government. The liberal free lunch thinking is why we're broke. No. Actually, that's wrong. Both that we're broke, because I don't know who we are. I mean, I don't even know how Primer pretends to use the... How dare you use the word we? In the sentence before, you just said there is no we. There's me, and then there's those other people. So there is no we here, Primer. We are not anything. I don't know who it is you think is broke, but we, there is no we. You've just stated that. There is no we. There's just you and the people who don't have your good fortune. There's no we. And I don't know who you think is broke. Because we know that taxes as a function of GDP are significantly lower than their traditional percentage over the past 70 some odd years, 80 years. We know that there's plenty of money out there. So I don't know who your we is, but you're also wrong about brokenness. Put your welfare giveaway free lunch thinking where the sun doesn't shine. Touche. Touche. Coming up with the Welcome Back Cotter reference. Nice one. All I can say to you, Primer, is up your nose with a rubber hose. So I have some probably bad, but surely unexpected news for my conservative friends. According to LiveScience.com, now I know this is science, so, you know, and I don't, can't back it up with my Creationist Museum guidebook that I also have, but research finds that children with low intelligence are more likely to hold prejudiced attitudes as adults. Low intelligence adults tend to gravitate toward socially conservative ideologies, the study found. Those ideologies, in turn, stress hierarchy and resistance to change, attitudes that can contribute to prejudice. It is just a self-perpetuating perpetuating cycle. You're dumb. You grow up to be prejudiced and or conservative. And by nature of you being conservative, you become more prejudiced. I'm sorry, I'm just the messenger. But let me explain this so that you as a conservative can understand, because obviously science says that you're not smart. You are dumb. You are not smart. The things you believe in, you believe them because you're stupid. Can we write that phonetically underneath me? Polling data and social and political science research do show that prejudice is more common among in those who hold right-wing ideals than those of other political persuasions. Researchers turned to two studies of citizens in the United Kingdom. One has followed babies since their births in 1958, and another that did the same for babies born in April 1970. The children in the studies had their intelligence assessed at age 10 or 11. As adults, as age 30 or 33, their levels of social conservatism and racism were measured. In the first study, verbal and nonverbal intelligence was measured using tests that asked people to find similarities and differences between words, shapes, and symbols. So in other words, for my conservative friends, there was a test, like a quiz, like it would ask you a bunch of questions. And it would have like a magic marker and a pen. And it would say, how are these two things similar? Yes, yes, they're both long. And yes, I'm holding them both. But that no, there's another way that they're similar. That's really unique about these things. No, it's not that they both have colors, because mostly everything has colors. No, what's one more thing? No. This is a magic marker. It starts with an M. This is a pen. It starts with a P. Almost. No, they both. But ink comes out. You can write with them. Sorry for that digression, folks. Sometimes we have to slow down what we're doing for the people in the back of the class. The second study measured cognitive abilities in four ways. That's like thinking process. And four. You know, you remember four. Including number recall, that means like, can you remember numbers? Shape drawing tasks.
Four is the thing that comes after oops.
Yeah.
One, two, oops, four. Defining words and identifying patterns and similarities among words. Low intelligence in childhood corresponded with racism in adulthood, but the fact that it explained the relationship between these two variables was political. When researchers included social conservatism in the analysis, those ideologies accounted for much of the link between brains and bias. People with lower cognitive abilities also had less contact with people of other races. Now, of course, the researchers want to make it clear this does not mean that all conservatives are dumb and all liberals are smart. One of the researchers gave the example, we can definitively say men are taller than women on average, but you can't say if you take a random man and a random woman that the man is going to be taller. There's plenty of overlap. So for those of you who are offended because you're conservative out there and you're saying, I'm not dumb. I figured out how to use YouTube or turn on the radio or stream this, then you may be one of the exceptions to your fellow ideologues. And so for you, I say congratulations. And you may run into a stupid liberal. And that, of course, is the exception to their fellow ideologues. So, you know, hang in there. As an individual, you can always supersede your limitations. And, you know, it's science. You don't believe in that anyway, so don't worry about it. Jay in Connecticut, welcome to the program, Jay.
I just happened to hear what you said about this rationalization of climate change that certain people engage in. I have a guy, very nice man, sits in the cubicle next to me, and he says climate change is global warming is universal throughout the solar system, that all the planets are getting warmer, it's not Earth. And I thought, that is one I'd never heard before. So I searched for it high and low on the internet. It doesn't exist as a theory, as far as I know. But it's bedrock for this fella.
Wow.
And when you say
when he says something like that, like I've heard people say like it's the sun, sun's getting hotter, and in a way, it's true in the sense that like, well, it's heat is being. You know, the sun's getting hotter in the same way like your house gets hotter if you insulate it more. The effects of the sun, I guess, make it hotter. But did you say to him like, oh, that's really fascinating. Is there a place I could read more about that?
It's dicey. He will engage in. I don't want to provoke him because if I do,
I'm saying you can present that to him like, wow. That's very cool. That makes total sense. Hey, where can I read more about that so that I can tell my Jewish
thing.
Friends or something? You know, I don't
that
know.
Particular thing, that specific claim he made was to someone else, and I overheard it, and I don't like to be presumptuous. The few times I have crossed into his lawn, so to speak, he was explained to me that Scooter Libby was set up, and then it wasn't a real crime. It was only a process crime, despite the multiple felony convictions. And another time, he's explaining to me, of course, that the government doesn't work. And I asked him, you know, what about the interstate highway system? And he dismissed it. And I said, well, how about the FAA?
How did he dismiss it? Yeah. FAA, he said we should privatize.
He didn't say that. He actually, and this, I could not believe he said state and local does it better.
Right.
And there's nothing to say to that. There's no response. He says it's the government should just get out of the way and let people do what they're going to do because they get it done.
Oh, it's definitely true. Like coming over and taking his crap on his desk.
Well, the FAA, what if, you know, Connecticut and Massachusetts are, you know, one's on a 5-day work week and one's on a 6-day work week and the planes are flying between the two states? That could potentially be an issue.
Or what if they have different technologies that they decide to use? Because,
One governor's brother-in-law is in one business of this technology, and one's in another. I'm sure they'll work it out. I wouldn't worry about it. Really, what it should be is it should be down on a city level. Well, every time you pass over a town or a city, that you get dropped to that one dude or lady who works in their local aviation agency, and it's like
when you meet.
I mean, look.
People who tend to be avidly against the federal government seem to focus on county centrality.
Oh, well,
they
that's
like
where
the sheriff.
Oh yeah, the county.
They like the sheriff concept.
Yeah, no, the county,
the idea of a sheriff.
County aviation agency is probably best. That's probably makes more sense. Then you'd only like in a state like Massachusetts, you could fly from Boston to say, let's say, to Great Barrington,
Lenox.
And you'd have Lenox, and you'd have like you'd only deal with like three or four different air traffic controllers, and you're passing through Worcester County. Okay, you're out of Worcester County. We're gonna pass you over on to Springfield. Unbelievable. Well, you know, I got news for you, Jay. That dude's a lost cause.
Yes.
That dude's a lost cause until
I don't try to convince him of anything. But the thing is, he does listen to Rush Limbaugh audibly. See, I listen to your program podcast on headphones.
You got
to
get a little more aggressive.
He has a radio.
Well, you got to get a little more aggressive. Why?
Aggressive?
Yeah, well, why are you letting this dude blast Rush Limbaugh, but you're putting me on headphones?
You want to go head-to-head?
Do it, Dan! Were you kidding? I definitely want to go head-to-head. And then I want that dude to call in.
Then he's going to call for regulation, I think, at that point.
Well, there you
go.
He's
going to want the government to intervene.
Jay, you got to step up. You got to step up. You got to throw down the gauntlet. This guy's treading all over your airspace right now.
I have to get one of those signs with a picture of a snake on it, one of those flags. What are they called?
Yeah, don't tread on me. Don't tread on my Sam Cedar. You're going to start playing it louder. And then you can IM me, and I can actually just start addressing things directly to him. What's the guy's name?
My coworker's name is Mark. He's a very nice man.
It's no, I'll just be going like, now, this one's for Mark. We got to do it.
You're going to personalize your polemics, I think.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that, no problem.
Between weddings.
Exactly. Jay, I appreciate the call. As soon as you do this, as soon as you start cranking up, I'll send you speakers. Thanks for calling. I'll send him speakers. This dude, the guy next to him plays Rush Limbaugh, and he's putting me on headphones? That's wrong.
If you have a coworker that's like that, think about how much fun this show would be if you were blasting it on your radio and he heard it and felt inspired to call in to debate Sam on something.
Oh.
Imagine how much fun you would have sitting there in between this. You're listening to Sam.
I don't
on
understand
the show.
How everybody listening to the show right now is not blasting it to their coworkers. And any conservative who comes over and tells you can't do that, you say, stop treading on me, man. This is my freedom. This is about freedom. Why don't you love freedom and liberty?